This is the Own It Show, where we tell stories of how everyday people made ownership theirs to create extraordinary success.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to another week of the Own It Show. I'm Justin.
And I'm Elise. Welcome to the show.
This week, guys, we've really kind of gone through our past couple guests and talked about just how we can level ourselves up and taking a look at the examples of our guests and how they've truly embodied not just what they, the words they speak, but truly how they lived. And this week is another person that lives exactly that way. Our guest today was ultimately ran multi-billion dollar investment funds and struggled with his health for a long time, had gone up and down through different roads, and ultimately decided to leave a very lucrative career and start operating in health, start empowering others to give them solutions to ultimately optimize their health and increase global prosperity. And he is the CEO and founder of Human Co. And we could not be more excited to have him with us today. But Mr. Jason Karp, thank you so much for joining us and being with us and ultimately sharing your wisdom and utilization of ownership in your life with our listeners.
Well, thanks for having me.
Jason, can you kind of lead us in and tell us a little bit about your journey through to where you are today? Because I mean, it is so different. Not only did you give up something that was solid and extremely lucrative, but you went with something that you were also extremely passionate about and that brought you extreme fulfillment, but meant something to you. How can kind of talk our audience and our listeners through that journey for yourself?
Yeah, it wasn't an easy journey. And I think a lot of what brought me here was out of necessity, was out of a lot of difficult periods. I think for up until I started Human Co., in some respects, I kind of had two lives. I was in the hedge fund industry for just under 21 years. In my early 20s, I got very sick and was diagnosed with several autoimmune diseases and was going blind at the age of 23. And was given what felt to me at the time a death sentence, where they said it was incurable and I would probably be fully blind by the age of 30. And I think for anybody, that's a horrible prognosis. I was also, you know, really depressed. I was already starting to see that there was not the connection that I had hoped with financial success and happiness. I was in my first 2-3 years of working, I ended up accomplishing more and being more financially successful than I ever had dreamed. But everything else was falling apart in my life. And it was a very long and introspective period for me where I had to really figure out, you know, A, how to cure myself, because I refused to accept that the Western medicine kind of dogma was correct, that I would have to take a lot of pills for the rest of my life to keep the symptoms at bay, and that I wouldn't ultimately be able to cure what I had. I just didn't believe that. And it wasn't based on anything at the time other than naivete. I mean, I didn't want to believe it. And I always thought I was modestly healthy. I was a Division I athlete in college. And I could not believe I went from that to 2 years later being, you know, very sick with a bunch of different diseases that were supposed to be unrelated, but were all obviously interconnected. I ended up over the course of 9 months to a year reversing all of my disease through food and lifestyle. To the surprise of several of my doctors who had never seen somebody do this, and this is back 22 years ago. And so that taught me a lot of lessons coming out of that, period, particularly around the value of doing your own research, not necessarily accepting kind of expert advice if it just doesn't seem to make sense. You know, I am a data-driven person. I was trained in kind of science and engineering. And so I just went and did a lot of my own research and tried to derive and create my own hypotheses around how I could cure myself. And ultimately it worked. And that was very empowering to be able to do that. That really changed who I was as a person coming out of that episode, because it made it feel like I had incredible agency and control over what I could do and what I could not do. And it also sort of really woke me up about how problematic modern lifestyles are. You know, I think I was an exception, but in many cases, in sort of another way to look at it, I'm kind of like a canary in the coal mine, where a lot of what made me sick is making everybody sick. It just made me sick in 2 years. And most people, it takes 30, 40 years to get what happened to me. And I can later talk about why I believe that happened. And because of that, I had to become an expert on everything from nutrition to basically anything you put in your body, right? Which I'll call food, beverage, supplements, nutrition, anything you put on your body, which I'll describe as sort of personal care, things like lotion, shampoos, et cetera. And as you probably know, your skin is your largest organ and absorbs pretty much everything you put on it. And so I was suffering from some of that too. And I had to really just understand everything around me that was making me sick. And then I realized that this is everywhere and it's almost inescapable. And so I stayed in the hedge fund business for another 17 years after I cured myself. I'm not fully cured. I'm basically in remission, and I have been for that long, but I have some relapses from time to time.
And that's why we're diving in deep together.
Correct. But you know, and then I had, many years later, I had my first child. And I now have two children. And I started also caring, obviously, about them and the next generation and what are we doing to our children and that generation in terms of the poison that we have in our food and the poison that we have in our environment. Around that time, my family and I created Hugh Kitchen. We're best known for our chocolate. I have one here I was eating earlier today. And that was sort of the first culmination of a lot of this work. And it started with a restaurant, and we wanted to create the first restaurant of its kind. And I don't think there has been a restaurant that has actually matched it in terms of its strictness of care around ingredient sourcing. We were a restaurant in New York City. The whole restaurant was gluten-free, dairy-free, refined sugar-free. We cured our own bacon. We made our own ketchup. We baked everything from scratch. Everything was grain-free and gluten-free. And we ultimately made our own chocolate. And that turned into a pretty large consumer packaged goods business. And as all that was happening, I realized that I bring a different perspective to the development of consumer packaged goods, because having been a professional investor for 21 years and been a capital allocator, a lot of the entrepreneurs in that space didn't quite have the background that I did to understand kind of how to make a good business be a good business. And I wanted to help those entrepreneurs, and I wanted to basically provide what I had learned to them so that we could have many, many more products that are better for people, better for animals, and better for the planet. And then ultimately, in the beginning of 2019, I retired from the hedge fund industry to create HumanCo. which is the health and wellness holding company that I've built with my partner Ross over the last 2.5 years. So it's been a really interesting journey. And my goal now is just to make healthier living easier, more accessible, and more understandable for everybody. Because even today, which is way better than 22 years ago when I was really sick, even today, it's so confusing. It's so difficult. You're bombarded with so much misinformation and fake news. And there's just a lot of stuff out there that I still don't think is that good. And so we're trying to change that. And that's been my focus.
Well, congratulations to you, because it's an extremely impressive story. And I will say you certainly make it easier for Justin and myself. We are big fans of Hue products, particularly the chocolate.
Thank you.
If you can believe it, Justin actually has a bigger sweet tooth than I do.
Yeah, I can believe that.
He saw me dive into the Cocoa Bliss ice cream that day.
Yeah, Coconut Bliss.
Light,
yeah.
It was the big like 5-barrel, and I think I went back 3 times.
Oh gosh. But one of the things that we talk about often, Jason, on this podcast is the idea of ownership. And there's pre-ownership and there's post-ownership. And there's oftentimes an event or a burnout or some sort of life-changing thing that happens that takes you from living in pre-ownership to then living in post-ownership. For you, it sounds like it was probably the diagnosis of your autoimmune disease. Not sure if it was something else, but I know you spoke about it in a way that it certainly had a big impact on your life. What I'm really curious to understand is it takes a certain level of external ways to be able to level up and make these changes, but what qualities was it within you and within your mindset? You made a comment that you said you were a completely different person. I really want to dig into that pre-ownership and that post-ownership version of you and what changed and what it was about you that allowed that change to happen.
That's a great question. It actually came well before this episode. And I don't think I would have been able to have the courage to doubt a bunch of very accomplished Western medicine doctors. I wouldn't have had the courage to even doubt them if I hadn't had many transformative experiences where I did things that people sort of thought either I shouldn't do or were impossible. And, you know, I think from early childhood, I've always been a bit anti-establishment. I've always had issues with authority. I don't mean in the legal sense. I just mean like I've always felt like I want to do it my way. And I think that's consistent, by the way, with a lot of entrepreneurs, because you kind of have to make some crazy bold bets to do this. I had a few experiences that I remember from high school and college that were required a tremendous amount of deferred gratification, required a tremendous amount of discipline and hard work that many people told me not to do. For example, I was a competitive tennis player growing up. I dislocated my shoulder when I was 16. It kind of derailed my tennis career, so to speak. And when I got to college, I could have played on the tennis team, but was sort of burnt out. My shoulder was kind of a mess. I think everyone thought I was going to play tennis in college. And I decided because of a kind of a lucky incident with a gentleman who was in my freshman hallway at school, who asked me to hit some squash balls with him. And I really liked it. I decided to try to play college squash at a Division I school that was number 5 in the country as a walk-on, having only played twice in my life, which everyone said to me, like, are you out of your mind? Like, nobody does that. And I just didn't even, I didn't even care. I went up to the coach, and this was one of the pivotal moments of my life. And I went up to the coach and I said, look, I'm in really good shape. I'm supposed to play tennis, but I don't really want to play tennis anymore. Would you take me on your team as like the worst player? And I'm very good with, you know, hand-eye coordination. I think I could be good, but I'm going to need a lot of training. And he said, if you can make it through our preseason, you'll have a spot. And thankfully, preseason was basically just all war of attrition. And it didn't involve a lot of squash skills, because I obviously would not have made the team if it did. And it was just lots of running and swimming and brutal, like, physical demands. And I just had a great willpower to be able to push. And long story short, I made it through preseason, and he gave me the 20th spot on the team out of 20 people. And over the course of 4 years, through a ton of work and training by myself and training over the summer, I ended up, 35th in the United States in an academic all Ivy and all American. And it's not what I actually accomplished. It was also that a lot of my peers were saying, why would you take on a new sport in college when you could be partying? Like, you're going to obviously have a lot more fun if you're not doing a new sport that's 3 hours a day. And it kind of sounds insane in retrospect that I actually voluntarily chose that. I don't actually fully know why I chose it at the time. I wanted the challenge, but I had a few things like that in college, nothing that major, where I was told, like, no one's ever done this, don't do it. And I did it. And I did that in like 3 or 4 different areas before I got sick. And so I had the self-confidence that I could do things that people said were not possible, or at least were not likely. And that to me was sort of the beginning of me feeling ownership over my decisions and my capabilities. Recognizing that I obviously have many strengths and weaknesses. And I just learned through college in particular how to use my strengths, and also how to kind of deal with my weaknesses.
Yeah, it's almost as if the idea of being a maverick is one of your superpowers.
Yeah, I think maverick's a probably appropriate word.
It's funny because, like, it's one of the words that I relate to so heavily, is that, and as you were saying, like, problem with authority, just wanting to do things your own way, not seeing things the same, seeing things differently. It's something that I relate so heavily with you. And you had mentioned earlier on in your story where you were talking about your diagnosis, and you're like, I just refuse to accept that. I refuse to accept that this is the way it is. What were you able to do, and what were you willing to do to get yourself ultimately to that level of health?
I think I was willing to do everything. And I think one of my strengths is my willingness to endure extreme pain and endure, and I don't mean just physical pain, I mean mental pain, I mean deferred gratification. I've always been able to exert extreme discipline and willpower in things where I want to do it. I think honestly the hardest part, I was 23, single, in New York City. The hardest part was honestly giving up alcohol. I think all the other things, whether it was refined sugar or processed food or caffeine, or gluten or dairy, all those were pretty easy. I drank a fair amount in college, probably not more than the average college student, but certainly the average college student drinks a lot more than all of us. And I don't really drink alcohol anymore. You know, I was in this sort of work hard, play hard mentality. We'd go out after work, you know, 8 o'clock at night, we'd have a cocktail or two, wake up early in the morning, not work out, have some coffee. So working really long hours, alcohol every night, coffee every morning, not exercising, a lot of stress. And that was very kind of polar opposite to the way I lived in college, right? Where I was behaving like an athlete that cared about his performance. So I was willing to endure a lot. I think I made some mistakes, which I think are quite typical in overachievers, which is I sort of thought like, let me see if I can keep pushing this envelope of less sleep. And that was a massive, massive error on my part, which ultimately I think led to my downward spiral. I wanted to see if I could sleep 3 hours a night and perform. And I wanted to like read, you know, as much as I could. And I wanted to get ahead and I want, you know, and just all of this like American work ethic stuff. I wanted to keep pushing and see how far I could take it. And, well, I think that's ultimately what made me sick. Mm-hmm. The result was like literally my body just imploded on itself and broke down. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like redlining your engine for way, way too long. And then the engine just fails. I think I psychologically was able to push my body way farther than my body would have allowed. And I think that was a critical mistake. And ironically, my tremendous willpower was what made me sick, because I didn't listen to the cues of my body. And I just forced and forced and forced myself for the benefits of work ethic to violate whatever my body was telling me, like, stop, stop, like, relax, like, recover. And I just pushed and pushed and pushed and didn't listen.
Yeah, that willpower is an amazing strength until it's not.
Mm-hmm.
So I want to understand, Jason, you said you were diagnosed earlier on in your career with this autoimmune disease, but it wasn't until 17 years later that you decided to make the transition. Talk to me about why, after learning so much about yourself, you stayed in that lifestyle, and then what it was that allowed you to make this transition, and ultimately what you learned about yourself in that process.
Well, I still liked a lot of aspects of that career, and I was also very good at it. And it was the type of career that, obviously, if you were good at it, it was very lucrative. And I was still kind of the mindset, even after coming out of that, that like a lot of money would lead to happiness, which is obviously not true. Enough money leads to happiness, and they've documented that. Like, once you get above, like, you're covering your rent, you can eat every day, you can have basic comforts. Like, there's a significant difference in happiness when you go from poverty to that level of security. But once you can basically cover all your normal human needs, it's basically no correlation between money and happiness. And in some cases, it's inverse. There's many, many ultra rich people who are miserable people, because they can't stop the game of just trying to accumulate more and more and more of something that'll never fill the hole that they're trying to fill. And I had to learn that the hard way. So I did like the profession. I found it very interesting. I had a lot of different roles within the hedge fund world as I kind of, you know, moved up in my own learnings and in my own career trajectory. And I obviously had to adjust my lifestyle so that I wouldn't get sick again. And I had several relapses along the way. it was never anywhere as bad as what happened to me in the first period. But I just kept trying kind of different versions of professional investing. I worked at a couple places. I eventually launched my own hedge fund in 2012. And I sort of like, I wanted to have my own kind of canvas that I could paint with how I invest and how I like to do things. And I felt like that was a necessary kind of end of final chapter of that career, because I needed to see what it was like by building a business, scratching that entrepreneurial itch. But I think ultimately, you know, I ended up accomplishing everything I ever had wished in that field. All the kind of milestones that I had hoped to do, I had done. And I remember feeling this emptiness when I kind of, the way I describe it is, I got to the top of the mountain and there's nothing to see. And when I hit that moment is when I actually hit mental rock bottom and went through just a very significant period of depression again, because I felt like I had just worked my entire life to do something that ultimately wasn't exactly what I think I wanted. And now I'm sort of looking at the mirror empty and trying to figure out what it is that actually will, you know, provide me with the fulfillment that I kind of wished I had.
It's such a, I resonate so heavily with what you're saying, and I know Elise does as well, because it's, we've both seen that same mountain, and it's amazing just hearing you say that. And I wrote this down. It's, you can absolutely hear the power in your voice when you say, I got there and I realized that it's time to move on. There's something else that I need to move on to. And I just want to honor you for that, because it's a very empowering feeling. And I know a lot of our listeners probably have that same thing going on at this very moment, where they're trying to get to the top of that mountain, whatever that mountain is for them, only to realize that they get there and the answer is this it?
Well, it's empowering yet frightening at the same time.
It is very frightening. And it's, you know, and I think the other thing that has been clear to me since now I've moved on to my next chapter, I was chronically sick for 20 years, and it wasn't acute sick like I was when I was 23, when I was literally like acute, like I was actually dying when I was like 23. I mean, I was severely ill. But when I recovered from that, I didn't have many periods of what I would describe as optimal health after that. Like, I felt a lot better than the acute sick part, but now that I know what it feels like to feel healthy, I was never like this in the previous 20 years. And so I was struggling for, you know, that whole period, always being kind of fatigued, having low grade infections, you know, always just not like being optimal. And I didn't know it. And I think a lot of people don't know what good feels like because they haven't had it. Then when you show them, this is what good is, they're like, oh my God, I can't believe I've been feeling like that for the last 15 years.
Yeah, exactly.
It's crazy.
Yeah. And you talk about this idea of feeling good and living optimally. Do you believe this change happened more so in your body or in your mind, or was it really a combination of leveling up in both?
I think they're completely related and interconnected. I think a lot of physical manifestations of illness are a function of what's going on in your mind. I was constantly stressed. I wasn't acutely stressed. I had more chronic stress. Just always on, always alpha, always trying to win and do more and do better. And like, and I never gave myself the ability to recover and relax because I thought relaxing was lazy. And so a lot of my physical health improvements have come from my mental health improvements, mm-hmm. not the other way around. I think mental health leads physical health. And then obviously physical health helps with mental health, but, and it's obviously a virtuous cycle. But I think in a lot of people's cases, it's the mental health of finding recovery periods, finding relaxation periods, not being in like red line zone all the time is necessary for your physical health to be what it should be.
Yeah, I mean, we agree with you completely. At Own It, we believe that in order to be holistically healthy, it is a complete combination of mind and body. So as you and I dive in deeper, actually, Jason, there's an idea of what I like to call stress energy as catabolic energy. And what you were describing, this always being in, always being the alpha, always pushing a little bit more, right? Always having to be a little bit better. This is the idea of catabolic energy, and it is essentially living in a sympathetic or a stress state for most of our lives. The crazy thing is that 85% of people live here most of the time.
Definitely.
Did you earlier on in your life? And it is a mental challenge to have to be able to pull ourselves out of that, to choose to live differently, because at the end of the day, it is our choice. But it's a conscious choice that comes from awareness of how we're living. It's essentially your story, right? You had the awareness, you had this external physical ailment, this disease that was a slap in the face to say, hey, you got to get better. But ultimately, like you said, it goes back to all these other things that had nothing to do with your physical diagnosis.
Yep. Yep.
And I love what you said too, because there's two different paradigms. There's a lot of times where people talk about managing time and continuing to push. And it's the paradigm of downtime's wasted time, that life's a marathon. You got to just keep pushing, doing more. But that true paradigm of managing energy and understanding that downtime's productive time, that life is a series of sprints. We have to go hard and then we have to give back to recover so we can go again. It's really what you've learned yourself by going through this process over the last 25 years that's brought you to this new understanding. With all of this knowledge that you've gained through your experience, what would you say is your definition of ownership?
I think it's having confidence in your decisions to do things that feel right, that may be a bit unconventional. I think ownership is all about confidence, because not confidence in terms of like overconfidence or arrogance, but confidence in that you have agency, you have the ability to improve your outcomes. You have the ability to improve your life. I think a lot of people feel like they were dealt a bad set of cards, and, you know, or this notion of fate. And there's a lot of defeatist attitudes, you know, and the fixed mindset attitudes, as opposed to the growth mindset of believing you can change anything. I didn't fully appreciate until probably a lot of therapy and some interesting discussions with my wife, and now reflecting on my children. Like, I had a significant learning disability as a child, and it was never diagnosed. I had very profound ADHD as a kid. It runs in my family, which we now all know, but back then nobody talked about ADHD as a thing. I was just that hyperactive kid who could never sit still in class. But my ADHD was so significant, I could not read long passages. I didn't read a full book until I was 17 years old. And like, it took me a long time to finally like admit that and to recognize that I was learning disabled, because I was always very proud of my intelligence. And I had a few teachers along the way that really helped me basically learn how to channel my strengths. And, you know, the basic sort of background, in case it helps any of your listeners, is I have a form of ADHD where I actually hyperfocus, which can be a strength. And what some of my teachers noticed, and certainly my parents noticed, was that when it came to topics and subjects that I was interested in, which prior to probably 10th grade was things that were not useful in school. It was things like video games, weapons, gambling. Like, I was a savant in those areas. And people around me, when they'd see me talk about, you know, I don't know, history of gambling or card counting or video games, they'd be like, wow, I can't believe how much you know about that. But I didn't want to like learn about history in school. And so I had a very hard time. And a couple of my teachers who really took me under their wing, they saw potential in me. And between their guidance and my own kind of intuition, I sort of figured out that if it was something I was truly interested in, I was a hyper learner. But if it was something I wasn't interested in, I was significantly disadvantaged. And so I had to teach myself how to make things interesting. And when I figured out how to make things interesting, I became an amazing student. And I went from being an underperformer to being a top performer, because I figured out a way to make things interesting, to basically be more conducive to the way my brain worked. And now I find everything interesting. And now I'm a prolific reader and I love reading. And I read all the time, every day, and I love it. But I remember when I was like 17, 18, I couldn't read long passages. And that kind of experience taught me ownership. It taught me to say like, and by the way, nobody knew what I had. So I didn't have any diagnosis. I had no medications. I just knew I wasn't performing the way my peers were. And it really bothered me. And I had to own that. And I had to figure out, how do I make myself perform with my limitations, but then also leverage my strengths? And, you know, miraculously, I did figure it out. And I, you know, I ended up going to the, just to give you a perspective, and this is not to brag, this is to put into context how significant the change was. I went to a good high school that had 250 kids in my class. I wasn't even in the top half of my class in high school. I miraculously got into Penn, which is an Ivy League, and miraculously transferred into the Wharton School, which is the top school in the United States. It's got, it's harder and has stricter criteria to get in than Harvard does. And I graduated the top student athlete in Harvard and number three in my class, I mean, in Wharton. So I was the number one student athlete in the entire university. And I was the number three in my class at Wharton, having been not even in the top half of a high school. And that were the kind of things that taught me ownership, to figure out and be willing to acknowledge that I have a lot of weaknesses like anyone else, but that I have to figure out how to work with them.
It's such a great way to put it into perspective of how you apply what you learn. You apply what you learn about yourself. You apply what you learn about your surroundings and how to take that leveling up. And ultimately, you've said this so many times as well, ultimately be able to lean into that delayed gratification. Because of all the learning that you did, you didn't see the payoff until you were at Wharton. But it wasn't because you decided a day before you graduated, oh, I'm going to do something. it took 6 or 7 years ultimately to get to that point of learning how to learn, learning how to do that. Same thing with teaching yourself how to create health. It took you 25 years to get to the point that you're at today. It's going to take us on our journey a little bit longer to continue to get into even further enable that health journey. And so these are the things that I think are so valuable for our listeners to learn and understand, is that word of delayed gratification that you so greatly possess and have learned to lean into in a great way that has paid off 100x with the results that you've ultimately created for yourself.
Yeah. And it's important to remember that this stuff is iterative, 100%. That it's not, absolutely. None of it happens overnight. And you have to be willing to acknowledge when you make small progress. You know, each year in high school, I got better and my grades reflected that. I was a disaster freshman year of high school and, you know, literally all C's. And I started to learn how to learn using my strengths and weaknesses. But I was cognizant of the progress I was making and starting to realize like, oh, wow, if I do it this way, I learn it faster. And I started being cognizant of how to channel what I had. And I think it's important for everyone to realize like it's not overnight. And if you think about it as like some huge accomplishment, it sounds like it's completely unapproachable and impossible. But if you break that huge accomplishment into lots of little pieces, each one of those pieces is totally doable. And that makes it more welcoming and less intimidating.
Completely. Exactly. Find the joy in the process.
Jason, where can people find you? Where can people interact with you? And also, where can they interact with Hugh Kitchen and the different products that you guys operate within?
Okay, so I'm not that active on social, but I've been getting a little better. I'm on Instagram and Twitter. My handle is Human Carp. You'll notice everything I do has the word human in it, which is by design. I believe most of our modern problems are because we don't acknowledge how we've evolved as humans. And we do many things that are inconsistent and incompatible with human evolution. And like all of my philosophy, how I cured myself, all the food we do is all consistent with evolutionary principles. And it's actually not even that like challenging or difficult to understand how that works, right? We've evolved as hominids, you know, standing up things from the apes for hundreds of thousands of years. And we lived a pretty consistent way for 99.99% of that, which was as hunter-gatherers. And only in the last 150, 200 years has all this modern stuff, you know, from incandescent light bulbs to using cars instead of walking to eating 10 times a day instead of occasionally not going multiple days without food. Like all of these things are literally like 0.1% of our evolution. And it's drastically different than the other 99.99. And we expect ourselves to thrive. And in fact, we're the sickest we've ever been in human history. So that's why the word human is in everything I do. Hugh Kitchen, the chocolate company and consumer products company, is separate from Human Co. Hugh Kitchen, you can find at hughkitchen.com. And you can explore the products. That's mostly chocolate, cookies, and crackers. Everything is refined sugar free. Everything is grain free. Almost all of it's organic. All of it is, I think I said gluten-free. And then Human Co, you can go to humanco.com. That's the master brand. And then we have three individual brands underneath Human Co. We have Snow Days. You can find us at snowdays.com, which is the first organic, grain-free, gluten-free, grass-fed mozzarella cheese pizza bite. Ultra clean pizza bite. We have 4 flavors of that. We created that brand about a year ago. We also have Coconut Bliss, which is the only nationally distributed organic plant-based ice cream. You can check that out at coconutbliss.com. And then we have Against the Grain Pizza, which we just bought. It's actually Against the Grain Gourmet. It's a bakery. Decent sized business up in Brattleboro, Vermont. It's the largest grain-free pizza company in the country, which isn't saying much. Grain-free is also gluten-free by definition. Most people don't know that. So if it says grain-free, it's always gluten-free. So those three brands you can find. And so, yeah, on Instagram and Twitter, it's at Human Carp. And that's how you can follow us.
Amazing. And guys, each one of those products is incredible. I actively use all of them in, at least in my life, and they are spectacular and can easily find their way into yours. So guys, as you go forward, the big thing to understand here is that ownership is confidence in being different. It's confidence in doing things differently, in operating differently. And we know we talk about all the time that we need to own our different. If we own our different, we can ultimately find success, because success is different. It doesn't come to everybody. And knowing that whatever journey you're on, you don't need to get there tomorrow. It's going to be an iterative process, something that's going to be step by step. We have to understand that if we can defer that gratification, what we will receive at the end or further will be even better. And it will create something beyond what willpower and pushing through the understanding of work ethic and willpower can ultimately get us. Because once we defer gratification, we grow our capacity. And growing capacity will always outwork what comes from the earthly possessions that we will gain. And so with that, guys, we know success is different. So be different, and we'll see you next week.